Oh, how many people have actually been here for the whole series? Anybody? All right. All right. This will be the last installment of Noah's Ark. Fourth and final week. And there's so much information on this topic that we could go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. So what I'm going to do is give you a taste of things and ask you to follow up and study on your own, because it can just go on, and these things that spring off of the whole story of Noah and the Ark will really increase your faith. It's awesome. So all I can do is whet our appetite today. We're going to touch on a couple more interesting points, but we're going to follow right through following Scripture in context like we have been doing. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, these words are so important, and they show us so much about You. Lord, I pray You would bless. You know the week that everyone's had. You know the week I've had. Thank You for Your love, Your mercy, Your grace. I ask You now to give strength. I ask You to take over. I ask this to be everything from You. That it would all be pleasing to You, and it would sink so deep in our hearts. In Christ's name, amen. This is some of the most fascinating information for me of all. Genesis 7:15. This is about where we left off, where we're going to pick up. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all the flesh, which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded them, and the Lord shut him in. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed, greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the water prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upwards, and the mountains were covered. And all the flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was a breath of the Spirit of life. All that was on the dry land died. So He destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping things, reptiles, and birds of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Now, when you read these things, especially if you haven't been to church in a long time, you immediately get your little fairy tale antenna coming on, because the last time you read it was probably in Sunday school, and you got the whole fairy tale story. And what you're going to see, and if you've been here, what you've already seen, is it's as far from a fairy tale as you could possibly get. So we're going to pick up right there. We're going to add on one description just a few verses back, three or four verses, that describe one more thing that needs to go with this, okay? And that is Genesis 7:11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, right there, what I want to jump into first, and you hear a lot of people talk about this. Where did enough water come from to flood the whole world? And we look at this description, and we look at what scientists have talked about for many years, and we get an idea. And this is very interesting. The first thing is, how many of you have ever heard about the potential of a water canopy in the old earth? Okay? I'm going to show you where that comes from. If we go back to Genesis 1:6, then God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. Now, this is a very scientifically possible thing, and they've run many computer models now, and they can even run different amounts of water that might be in this canopy that surrounds the earth to see what the temperatures would be like globally, whether it would superheat eventually and we would become a Venus, or just what it would take. And they've run a lot of models. And it's a very real potential that the early earth did have a greenhouse effect. And we're going to see that as we go on. One of the things that would be caused by a greenhouse effect, this is awesome. You say, "Well, Doug, you're just pulling stuff out of your ear." Well, just listen for a minute. Pretty awesome. And if you've heard anything that school has to teach you about evolution, you've heard a whole lot pulled out of somebody's ear. So you just wait, and you see where the facts are, and you see where the evidence is, and it'll blow you away. Now, First of all, if there were firmaments above the earth, why would somebody write this all those years ago? They weren't scientists. Why would they even write something like that? It would cause a greenhouse effect. A greenhouse effect, according to every model, would bring subtropical temperatures globally. You got a greenhouse effect, so it would not perfectly evenly distribute, but it would bring the heat around the whole earth, which means the poles would be warm, would be nice, would be almost tropical. Well, that's pretty neat. That would allow vegetation to grow, right? How many people know what's under the Arctic and Antarctic today? Right now today are forests and swamps and animals from all kinds of warmer climates that are found in the ice, in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. There are great coal seams along the Antarctic under the ice that shows there was lush vegetation at one time. Why? There had to be something to give that temperature or to move that land there, one or the other, because it sure doesn't match anything the earth could put out today, does it? But it matches the creation model beautifully. Genesis 7:11 says, the windows of heaven were open. Now I want you to listen close to this. Here is where I really get agitated, and this is why it takes me so long to do a message like this, and I want you to do the same thing. There's a lot of well-meaning Christians that can go off just as half-cocked as evolutionists, and they can take proof that they think is proof, and they can throw up there, and they can be as dogmatic about it as any evolutionist could be, and it's a falsity. So you have to be very careful that to the best of our ability, we really are reasonable, and we don't just try to throw evidence out there to win a war. Okay? You're not winning anything if you don't throw something out there that's credible. But Genesis 7:11 said the windows of heaven were open in the flood, and that most likely means a collapse of that canopy. Now, it would give excellent proof for drastic and immediate changes at the poles. If that canopy collapsed and the greenhouse effect was gone, and we've done many, many, many models of ice age. You want to talk about causing an ice age. If you drop the canopy that's giving you globally warm temperatures, like overnight, what do you think the eventual results are going to be? You've got all those warm oceans, and now you've got the canopy gone, and it's the most, besides the disasters it would cause, it would definitely bring an ice age within the years to come. That matches the evidence we have, and it matches the biblical model, if there was a greenhouse effect. Now, it would also mean what kind of rain would you have if an entire canopy of water collapsed around the earth? Torrential. Now here's the problem, and here's where some creationists have gotten a little too far. Okay? They say, well, there's where the rain came from to flood the whole earth. Well, now that we do have computer models and we can run these things, we keep adding to and adding to see what kind of a canopy we could have. And if you put a big enough canopy above the earth that when it collapsed, it flooded the earth, you'd have a Venus. Because we would be such a hot greenhouse, there would be no, we'd be cold. So, no. If you took what every computer model shows as being a reasonable canopy that would have the tropical temperature that we think was there before the collapse, and it all burst at one time and it all came in down in torrential rain, guess what you'd have? About 20 inches of water. Which is great! But it ain't gonna do much besides take Rubber Ducky down the street. So! We still have a dilemma. I do think there was a canopy. Everything you're going to see, everything in the model just matches. But that can't be where all the rains come from. And luckily, the scriptures don't say that's where all the rains came from. You got to read close. Canopy wouldn't be big enough. Wouldn't even be close. But now, here we go. We're going to read on. 7:11, Genesis 7:11 says this, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Now, the verse in Hebrew basically says exactly what it sounds like. It's describing massive eruptions, subterranean from the earth, from the ocean floor, massive, and that actual word, let me see if I can say it, baka, broken up. It literally means to rend, break, rip apart, divide. It means the earth in the ocean and on the earth was ripping and breaking apart and water was gushing out. Okay? So we have water gushing out. It strongly implies a tectonic event where the actual crust of the earth is busting apart and it's spewing water everywhere. So you've got, what do you think that would, you want to talk about a tsunami? Think of the tsunamis and tidal waves when the earth's crust is breaking up deep out in the ocean, and you have tidal waves coming in at almost the speed of sound all over the earth while you've got these torrential rainstorms. It was massive. It was unbelievable. Now, does it match what all the scars on the earth show? Or is it just a crazy fairy tale? Hold on to your hats, because it's an awesome study. But, now, what this probably also did is restructure the entire planet. Okay, when you've got this much tectonic involvement of the actual crust bursting open and water gushing forth. Now, so far, for those who get completely confused over all these things, what I'm going to do, okay, that's where the water came from. If you read Scripture closely, that's what it tells you. What I'm going to do after I give you this next point, I'm going to go back and we're going to revisit everything that I just said, and we're going to say, what does the earth say? What do the rocks say? Are we taking a shot in the dark? Are we taking stuff and trying to twist it to make it fit like evolutionists do? Or are the pieces really there if you just look openly? And you're going to really be amazed. But first, you know, you read this part and this part and this timeline and that timeline, and it's really hard to fit everything that happens in Noah all together. You're like, how long did it really take? And what happened from here to here? And what happened from here to here? So I'm going to really quickly, so that we can all understand, because we're getting ready to teach a bunch of kids. So you better know what you're talking about. I'm going to walk you through a really quick timeline and show you exactly how the whole thing happened from the moment they were in the ark until the moment they got out. Okay, and it won't take but 2 seconds. But a lot of us are confused on this, and I want you to see the timeline because it's going to play in. Here's how the timeline went. First off, here's a chronology of the flood. God gave a 7-day warning. He said, in 7 days, you've got 7 days to get the animals on the ark and get in there yourself, because it's getting ready to break loose. Okay? After that, the sky and the earth and the sea just erupted violently in storms for 40 days. And the water came up really quick for 40 days. Okay? Now, after that, here's where people sometimes get confused. After they've been pounded with earthquakes and tidal waves, and the flooding went to the highest mountain they had at that time, to a depth of over 20 feet above the highest mountain. All right. Now, then the waters leveled off and began to taper slowly. And the ark floated around for 150 days. Okay? The actual flooding just violently happened for about 40 days. Then they were floating around for about 150 days, and by the 150th day, the water had receded enough that it caught somewhere in the mountains of Mount Ararat. Now, you think, you got an ark that big. What if that baby had landed wrong? What if it had landed on the wrong ledge? What if the nose of that sucker just caught right on the edge of a cliff on the way down? It could have been rough. So I'm thinking God brought him into a nice, happy landing. But it was 150 days before that ark even touched. All right? Now, you think, oh, thank goodness, we landed. It's been 150 days. No. There was still, after that, 74 more days before the top of mountains where they could look out became visible, besides where they got caught on. Okay? After that, pieced all this together, there was another 40 days, and then God finally let Noah send out a raven. And this is very important. You always read, he sent out a raven. Then he sent out a dove. You see all the pictures. There's a lot of meaning to that. We're going to talk about it in a little bit. All right, so he sent out the raven after 40 days. Then he sent out a dove after 7 days. Then he sent the dove out again after 7 days. And then he sent the dove out one more time. And then he removed the cover. And the cover was 29 days later. The cover is that long expanse on the top where the windows were. He opened up the top of the ark. I'm thinking it was smelling pretty ripe by then. It was probably a very happy day. They probably had a deck party. I'm just saying, think about it. It's been a long time. And then lastly, finally, God gave them permission to exit the ark 370 days after they got on. That is the trip of Noah. 40 days flood, 150 days before he hit ground, 370 days before he got out. Nobody knows where the ark is today, and this is not in the notes, but I'm going to throw this to you. Is it possible that they might catch some foundational pieces of the ark one day for real? Absolutely possible. It could be caught up there, way in the mountains, frozen in snow, or trapped in volcanic molten lava, I don't know. But I'm going to tell you this. If the entire world is destroyed, and I have a wooden boat bigger than a football field and a half, and I land on a deserted spot with nothing, what do you think I'm going to go to for resources? I bet that ark was torn down like a car left in the ghettos of New York. In about 15 seconds, they were getting everything they could get off there. Plus, Kerry made a good point the other day. If you rode that ark for 370 days with nothing but a bunch of stinky, sweaty animals making poo, you're going to want to tear down that memorial quick as you can. That might have been when Noah invented dynamite. I don't know. But you're not going to want to see that ark. It is possible that it was torn down and used for resources. It makes a lot of sense. Does that mean that it was all torn down? Does that mean we won't find something? Absolutely not. I would love to see it. And we might. But if we don't, that's probably why. Now, this is awesome. Let me know you're with me. Give me a big amen.
Amen.
Give me a woohoo! Okay, you guys are in. Now look at this. This is awesome. Genesis 8:4. This seems like such a simple thing. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. The ark came to rest on Ararat, the 17th day of the seventh month. That is the month of Aviv. Okay? Now, you gotta get this. This is gonna be one of those aha moments that's gonna blow you away. Ready? God doesn't put anything in Scripture, let it be wasted. Landed on the 17th day of the seventh month. Now, on Passover, in Exodus 12:2, you can go back and read this, God gave a very specific command. He said, I'm going to take you guys out of Egypt. This is such an important occasion for the Hebrew people, and it happened in the seventh month of Aviv. Okay? He said, this is such an important occasion that I want you to change your calendars for all time and make this the first month of your year forever in memorial of what I am going to do today. So they took the month of Aviv and they moved it to the first month. Anybody remember that? If you don't, take my word for it. You understand what I'm saying? He's in the seventh month. He says, move this back to the first month. This is going to be the beginning of beginnings because this is when my people got freed. All right. So that now makes it Nisan. That is now the first month, which was really the seventh. Are you with me? Because I want you to get this, and I don't want it to be confusing. We took Aviv in Exodus and moved it back to become the first month. Now, this is so awesome. Passover, first month, the 14th, is the exact day that Jesus Christ was crucified. Okay? What happened 3 days after that? He arose, which would be on the 17th. Well, guess what day the ark landed on Mount Ararat to the day. On the 17th of the month of Aviv, which was Nisan, when Christ was on the earth. The very exact day that Jesus Christ arose to give us rest and salvation was the day that Moses wrote the ark landed on Mount Ararat. And it all fits. I got goose pimples talking about people. The entire Bible fits together like a perfect jigsaw puzzle. And yet the authors were thousands of years apart and never knew each other. Your Bible is God's breathed word. That's just one little piece of God's fingerprints. And it's just awesome. You get in there and you study, and God just, He'll just throw it out there to you and just let you see that He's real. Now, here's what we're going to do. I just felt like it was really nice to give you that little taste because God's awesome. We're going to go back and we're going to look at, okay, we know what happened on the flood now. Took a little time to show you, but I want to take the remainder of time. That's why I went through it kind of fast to talk about what the rocks say. What does the earth say? God has His fingerprints all over the world. And one of the reasons I told you that I don't think God just let everybody drop dead and disappear off the earth is because He wanted to show us for all times, all over the globe, that He is God. And yes, He did this. Okay? So what do the rocks say? If we had a worldwide cataclysmic disaster like a flood, it should have left a lot of proof. You think? If you think about it, every living creature on the earth was swept away in tsunamis and tidal waves, dashed into the rocks, driven down into the mud, drowned violently. killed and buried in fossilized sand and limestone and mud. So, if they were all brought to their watery graves through all the violence of a global flood, what kind of evidence would it leave? Check this out, people. How about billions of dead creatures and plants that have been killed and buried and fossilized all over the globe at every elevation and every continent? Does that seem to match what would happen? Pretty much. Fact of the matter is, listen to this, people. The fossil record, in its massive, unbelievable quantities, should not in any way, shape, form, or fashion exist today. There is no reason to have billions of fossils all over the world. Because what happens when something dies? If something dies today, if it's in the summertime, about 2 days later, you begin to realize what's happening as you drive by. Because it smells really bad. I'll give you an idea how it smells. When Micah came of age, and his body began to perspire. He had never perspired before. He came into the kitchen completely out of his mind, ran over to Zach, and said, "Zach, my armpit smells like a taco! Isn't that cool?" Micah, I didn't see you. I thought you were downstairs. I would have told that story. It's kind of what it starts to smell like. What happens when something dies? It rots away and it's eaten by scavengers. How many times do you see the deer get hit out on a country road? Sorry, Mike, I love you. And you see that sucker lay there until the earth just kind of forms over it by the time your kids start at the same plant you're working at. And you finally realize, hey, I'm so glad that baby finally got fossilized. I was tired of looking at it. No! Doesn't happen. It's gone in days, right? So how do you account for all over the globe at every elevation billions of fossils when it has to be sealed airtight almost instantly and kept that way before it can become a fossil? What causes that? Not a lot, right? You don't have enough tar pits in the world, evolutionary speaking, to cause billions of fossils. So, if you look at just that, there is no other explanation except a catastrophic event. And as understanding increases in this area, and I want you to go back and look at this, as the understanding increases and as the evidence mounts, there's a lot of evolutionists that are called neo-catastrophism. They are beginning to adapt catastrophic thinking because they're realizing, what are we talking about here? We didn't get this many fossils by things laying down and dying through the ages. And they're beginning to wake up a little bit with the evidence. Now, sedimentary rock that fossils are found in, we've now found out can form really quickly. Because what happens is sand and dirt and soot get wet and get moved by water. And while it's wet and pliable, it rolls over top of something and the water drains out and it gets hard very quickly. If you don't believe me, pour some quickrete in your goldfish bowl, and you will get a fossil. Because you will make some sedimentary rock very quickly. Pretty much the same thing. That's how sedimentary rock is made, and we realize it can be made very quickly. What better thing to make all the sedimentary rock that we see all over the planet where all these fossils are in, besides soft, pliable sand that got wet, rolled over top of something, and hardened? Woo! What does that sound like? Kind of, sort of, yeah. All right. Now, listen to this. I'm going to keep this short, but in order to give you an idea, and I'm just going to whet your appetite with little pieces because I want you to go back and look up some of these, give you an idea of scientifically how we need to approach this to let you know that this is not a fairy tale. I'm going to give you a few samples of things around the world that scream unmistakably, my God is awesome, and there was a cataclysmic flood, and I am not ashamed to stand up here and scream and bark it, although I'm not a scientist, because science is catching up. And I know my God is real. But when you hear these things, you're going to scream with me. All right? I'll give you one. There are billions of fossils. I'll give you this one example because they're all over the place. There are billions of fossils and a 7-foot thick layer called the Red Wall Limestone along the Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon is awesome because you can see many, many years of the evolutionary picture, okay? But that's not what it is. Now, this Red Wall Limestone stretches 108, get these numbers. I'm not just throwing them out here for fun. I want you to get this. This area that I'm talking about that goes all along the Grand Canyon stretches 180 miles, covering an area of 10,500 square miles, and has billions of fossils in this one little layer all the way around. Billions. Now, in order to create this layer of sedimentary rock, what happens to create sedimentary rock? It gets wet. It's compressed. It dries out. Okay. For this graveyard to be formed, they have figured that it would take 24 cubic miles of limestone and silt flowing like a slurry at 16 feet per second. 24 cubic miles of slush that would be moving 16 feet per second in order to create that layer of sedimentary rock. Now, where do you think something that big and wet and mushy came from in the geologic column of evolution? Wasn't because a whole lot of dinosaurs decided to go pee-pee at the same time. And no, that's not in the notes. I don't know what happens. That's pretty awesome. And you see this all over the geologic column, all over the world. Massive miles and miles of these sedimentary layers that happened at one time, which means a lot of ooze had to move together and trap billions of things. And it didn't just happen because a couple of dinosaurs slipped up in a tar pit. Now, look at this one. I love this stuff. And I want you to get in and read it. There are hundreds of thousands of sea creatures buried with land animals, birds, amphibians, spiders, and insects. How often have you ever seen a whale and a possum go hiking up a mountain? Yet up on mountaintops, we have fossils of big old whales laying down right next to Mr. Opossum. Now, I'm sure they were hard partiers, but I don't know how that one happened. And you see this. You see millions of sea creatures mixed in with insects and land animals all over the geologic column, all over the world, not just an occasional oops. It's not the exception. It's everywhere. How do you account for millions of sea creatures rolling up on the big party up on land and getting squashed in the mud instantly with a bunch of land dwellers, sealed so perfectly and so quick that they're fossilized together forever by the hundreds of thousands and even millions? Sounds like another tar pit to me. What is that describing, people? Do you have to have a whole lot of common sense to realize when you put it together what it's describing? It's an awesome picture. Awesome picture of the flood as the ocean slams in, bringing this sea life in and throwing it into the mud with the life that's already there and fossilizing them instantly. I just told you, there'd be tsunamis rolling in almost at the speed of sound. Now, I love this. In South America, 300 whales were found buried with land animals. That was a big party. 300 whales were found buried with land animals. Nothing in the evolutionary train of thought will tell us why these land animals were trapped with these sea creatures. It's one thing if they're buried with a couple of clams and trilobites. It's another thing if you've got 300 whales sitting up there with the possums. That's a problem. Now, number three. Every geologist, I don't care who you are, knows that on all the continents we find fossils of sea creatures in rocks that are far, far above sea level. Far, okay? And I'm going to give you just a couple of these. They're either above sea levels, sea creatures, or they're in unbelievably crazy spots. Let me just give you a couple, and I love this. One, at the top of the Grand Canyon, which is 8,000 feet above sea level, and in Arizona, you find millions of sea creatures buried. That doesn't make a lot of sense at all, does it? All right, how about this one? At the top of the Himalayas, 29,029 feet, the world's highest mountain range, you find them. All kinds of sea creatures buried at the top of the mountain. It's amazing. This one's really cool and very recent. In 2010, in the deserts of Chile, 80 huge whales were found along the highway by the highway expansion crew. They were flopped all over each other. They were laying down everywhere just under the soil and sedimentary rock. And they were in an area that was so flat that even if a flood had come, if it hadn't been catastrophically powerful, it would have just washed them there and rolled away, and they would have dried out in just a matter of hours, and they would have rotted. Something had to hit Chile, hard enough with enough water to bury 80 whales deep into mud so that even though the water washed away, they stayed there and turned into fossils. Holy moly! Does this not tell you that there was a massive catastrophic flood? These things are awesome. How many of you got to read these things when you were in high school? They're all there. They're all there for you to read. But you didn't get to see a lot of them. Now, fourth, there's been quick and almost perfect fossilization in that some animals that are fossilized have food that has not rotted in their stomach. Some fish were slapped into a wall and buried in mud so quickly that they were enjoying their last meal when it happened. I think I'll just have a... gone, fossilized, dead. Okay? Sorry. Okay? Now, some of them, it doesn't go with that picture, I changed it too quick. Some of these things that have compound lenses in their eyes were fossilized so quickly with such pressure and so perfectly sealed that the fossil that formed actually shows the compound lens of their eyeball. No deterioration, not a moment, perfectly sealed. And I'm not talking a few, I'm talking millions. All right, fifth, this is where this picture comes in. Now catch me on this. This seems simple, but when you grasp what I'm telling you, it's one of those aha moments again.
Say it with me. Every
continent. Every continent has layers of sedimentary rock that are unique, right, to that area. And that sedimentary rock, feet and feet and feet thick, has been washed across entire continents so that anywhere you go in the continent, it has that same level of dirt. That should not happen across an entire continent. Things change. Something powerful took a load of dirt and spread it across the entire continent on every continent so that the same layer of dirt was spread across everything, sometimes coming so hard and so far it reached other continents. And they can trace, well, it looks like this is where it came from. This is where the deposit came from. But my gosh, look how far it was strewn over X number of feet thick, and it'll go the entire length of a continent. How do you think that happened? And it's sedimentary rock that fossils are in. So I don't think it was a windstorm. What does that tell you happened? Massive, cataclysmic water event. If you look, you see all the pretty colors. In the Grand Canyon, there are six major sequences of rock that can be traced all across North America. If we dig, we find these same six sequences of rock that were laid down one over top of the other across the entire continent of North America. But you can see them because the Grand Canyon has been sliced down so you can look right into it. Sometimes when you're driving along the West Virginia highways and they've had to clear it and you see cliffs on both sides, you can see these layers. Same thing. It's awesome. Next time you go and look at one, you just give God the glory because it shows layer after layer that was laid down. Only a rapid, violent force could do this. Six. This is something you just don't think about. And then when you do, you're like, oh my gosh, why didn't we think about this? You see on here, I hope you can see that from that small picture, that shows layer after layer of sedimentary rock that was laid down and compressed on top of each other, right? Kind of like what you see when you're driving along the highway. Let me tell you the problem with that. There's supposed to be millions of years between every layer that you're looking at right now. What happens over a period of millions of years if you have land that lays there for millions of years? Does it erode? Do things lay there? Do bumps happen? Do ditches happen? Does it get debris? Well, you're supposed to be looking at millions of levels of layers, but if you notice, there's a perfect consistency as though they were all laid down one right after the other in a matter of hours or days. There is no erosion between a single layer. So how quickly do you think that those millions of years of layers had to be laid down to not show 1 ounce of erosion between one single layer of rock all the way up? And yet we can believe that happened over millions of years. The only motor that you've got going to try to make that boat float is the assumption that it was millions of years and you want to make it fit. So you come up with a story because there's no evidence there to make it fit. The model is not there. When you go back and look at it from a creationist view, there's not one thing I've shown you that doesn't fit, is there? Not one. Got goose pimples again. I wish y'all could get goose pimples as much as I do. I would know you were listening. Every time y'all get goose pimples, I want you to do the Muppet. So I'll know you're getting it too. Okay? Because this is awesome. If you're not getting excited about these things, you're dead. Or you really don't believe. Because this will get you excited. John was up here, he'd be amening me. Alright, now. This one's pretty awesome too. I'm going to give you one more and then I'm going to move on to something else I want to show you. Look at this mountain. Now you can find rocks and hills and entire mountains that way. Okay? What that is where a bunch of guys went snowboarding too much and they kept following the same trail. And no, I'm kidding, Micah. That's no. This is so awesome. These are multiple layers of sedimentary rock that folded and pressed together like an accordion. Okay? So, an evolutionist would tell you that happened over millions of years. Where it was this crazy shape and then another layer came and another layer came. The problem with that is if layers come and they set and they dry out over thousands or millions of years and you've got a shape like that, guess what every shape that fits into the other one will do? Unmistakably, we can test this, it'll crack. It'll break. You'll see breaks and cracks and imperfections where they had to mold together as they dried. There's only one way to make that happen. You know what it is? Everything is wet. Everything is churned. Everything is hot. It's all pliable like Play-Doh. The layers get mashed onto each other while everything is still wet, squished into a shape, and then left there to drain and dry and turn into sedimentary rock. Because there's not one break or scratch anywhere in those layers. The only way they molded that perfectly is if they all molded together while they were still wet. What could do that? Do you see how you can go anywhere as far as you want to go, all over the globe, and find any piece that you want, and not one piece fails to fit the flood model? But everything I've just shown you is rejected when you look at long-term uniformitarianism. My God is real. And I am not afraid of any science. Anything they do tell me that might scare you for a minute, I say, just sit down and hold on. Because they'll catch up. Because they always have. We are living in an information age that is rocking to be a Christian. Because if you'll just shut your mouth and open your ears and turn on the internet, you will discover some things, and you won't have to be a sheep that just follows what everybody says. Because God's fingerprints are all over the earth. It's awesome. Now, these are just a few examples, and there are so many. I could have gone 2 weeks just on this, honestly. I ask you to look it up. Some of you are saying that's all fine and good, and you weren't here the last week I talked about this. But what about the dinosaurs? Because the dinosaurs were in the sedimentary rock and they're supposed to be millions of years old. I'm going to kill you. Weren't they here 245 million years ago? And shouldn't rock formations be at least that old if the dinosaurs are in them? Because that's how old dinosaurs are. Well, you're brilliant. And I have to quit now. You've proven me wrong. No, let's sit here and talk about this. First of all, let me show you how that works. Jay, you've taught them this. Circular reasoning. This is how it goes. And people, because I don't have time, I didn't actually get this. But you can go in the school textbooks used today, and you can go in one chapter, and you can literally get a copy out of that textbook that says, the fossils are dated by the age of the rocks they are in. And then you can go over here to another chapter in the same book, and you can see it say, the rocks are dated by the fossils that are in them. True story. Because guess how much they actually really have to bet it on? Zero. It's circular reasoning. We've come up with an idea of what we think happened. So these must be geologic layers that represent time spans. So we're going to give them these ages. Well, a fossil's there, well, that must be its age. Well, this one's kind of out of spec over here. It doesn't exactly match. Well, this layer of dirt must be different. Right here must be where 200 million years are in this load of dirt. So they judge the rock by the fossil and the fossil by the rock. And you can come up with all this carbon-14 dating and everything you want, but it's not accurate back, if it was farther, than more than a couple of 10,000 years. And carbon-14 doesn't work after that. So don't let anybody say, well, we carbon-14 dated that 200 million-year-old dinosaur and we've got proof. It ain't happening. Carbon-14 doesn't work that way, and they know it, and it's a smokescreen if you hear it. But you gotta know. You gotta know. It's all circular reasoning based on an assumption. So you get into the real facts like I've just shown you today, and you find out, hey, those fossils that are along there that they're saying are 200 million years old? Nope. It was all laid down at one time. Do you have any more proof than that? I'm glad you asked. Let's continue. Now, get past the circular reasoning. Are there other reliable proofs that show me that dinosaurs aren't that old? You just showed me, okay, they don't have proof that they are that old, but you still haven't shown me that they could be younger. Well, first of all, let me tell you this, something you might not have known. Did you know that crocodiles, according to the evolutionary ladder, were alive during dinosaurs? And do you know that if you walk around in the wrong place, you can see a crocodile today? So why is it so hard for you to believe that there could be dinosaurs that lived with men not long ago if you know crocodiles lived with dinosaurs and crocodiles are still here today? And that's not a proof. That's just a stand up and recognize for a minute before we go on. Okay? Now listen to this. First of all, and I can't go into all of these, but I'm going to throw them out there and let you look them up. And here, my friends, is where you do get a lot of mess. Because you'll get a lot of fake artifacts that people want to sell. So you got to be careful what you look up. Okay? Ica stones, which I have used for years and were believed for years to be real. There were only a handful of them that were real. And the rest, when people found out, hey, people will buy these stones with dinosaurs on them. Let's make some. They started making fake ones. You got to know that you know that you know what you're talking about before you go out there and start throwing information out. But there are some things that are absolutely unmistakable. An evolutionist will still try to shoot a hole in it because to accept it would mean what? Everything I believe is false. Just like if I came to you and proved unmistakably something that would disprove Jesus Christ, some of you would say, I don't care what your proof is, I ain't believing it. Evolutionists play the same game. Let me just give you two or three things here that are pretty awesome. First of all, there are all kinds of oral and written reports from China, England, and Australia, and other places that describe in great detail creatures that look like dinosaurs that men have had fights with, hunted, used. And you can see these written and oral testimonies. And they're all over the world. Secondly, there are drawings. This is real. And this one was argued. An evolutionist went to see it and he first said, oh, holy moly, it's a dinosaur picture. And they said, but it can't be. That would ruin everything. I think it's a snake that was drawn on that cave, and then something was spilled on the cave that bleached the rest of the rock that made the rest of the picture. True story, that's how it was explained. There is zero evidence that that happened. It's obvious that it's a picture, but that is the only explanation that they can try to give to counter it. It is still an officially proven carving on the wall. It's in Natural Bridges National Monument in Utah. It's called a petroglyph. And it resembles a sauropod dinosaur. Now, the problem is the sauropod was supposed to be gone 64 million years before this guy did the drawing. And he wasn't an archaeologist. So we got problems. Tells you somebody saw one, doesn't it? In the ruins of to Prom in Cambodia. Let me let you look at that real close. See that there? Now, what this is on a gate in these ruins in Cambodia that are from the 9th century. Okay? And it's pictures of, let me see what the other pictures are. Pigs, monkeys, roosters, and snakes. All of which they all seen in, every day, right? Right in the middle of the pigs and monkeys and snakes is that picture that someone carved in the 9th century. Now, when that was discovered, evolutionists freaked out. Now, look closely. I am not lying. This is what a Smithsonian worker blogged. Now, this is just an unofficial blog, luckily. This is what they blogged trying to discredit it because no one has been able to officially discredit it because it's a 9th century and it was carved in a wall. They said, that is not really a dinosaur at all. It's a rhinoceros with pictures of leaves behind it. True story. The second thing he wrote on his blog, and do you see how ridiculous it is? How could a scientist look at that closely and try to come up with that? Here's the second one. Well, a lot of movie producers come through this area wanting to shoot clips for movies because it's such an exotic land. Some of these movie producers are very dramatic, and one of them probably carved it on the wall to just do something dramatic. So he went to a 9th century artifact and carved over top of the original carvings and put that dinosaur there to make it seem exciting. Doesn't know who or where or when, he just assumes that rumor has it that's what happened. This is true, you can look up the blog. This is how desperate the attempt has been to knock this out and say it didn't happen. So, and there are many other accounts like this where there's either a written story or a drawing where someone saw a dinosaur and drew a picture or did a carving of it, although we were supposed to be separated by 64 million years. I'm sorry, the evidence doesn't match that. Now, are you ready? Lastly, indisputably, awesomely, I wanted to say this too. At this point, which even shocked me because I didn't know it, there have been numerous dinosaur bones found that still have intact red blood cells and soft tissue. Well, why is that a big deal? Because they're supposed to be 64 million years old. Kind of a problem. If my mother-in-law croaked tomorrow, I don't think you're still going to find red blood cells on her in 64 million years. Right? Okay, let me read this to you, and I found it in all kinds of creationist sites. But I went to, and I went to a lot of secular sites on this because it's one of those things that even made me go, really? I'm going to get up here and teach that, and I'm going to look like an idiot. Because somebody's going to come back and say, did you really read this closely, Doug? Because look. So I went to a lot of secular scientific sites, and this is the one I decided to quote. It's from the Smithsonian. And we just saw how far they went to disprove the dinosaur, right? The drawing. Probing a 68-million-year-old T-Rex, Mary Schweitzer stumbled upon astonishing signs of life that may radically change our view of ancient beasts. It was big news indeed last year when Schweitzer announced that she had discovered blood vessels and structures that looked like whole cells inside that T-Rex bone, the first observation of its kind. The finding amazed colleagues who had never imagined that even a trace of still soft dinosaur tissue could survive. Later, Schweitzer recalled, I looked at this, and I looked at this, and I thought, this can't be. Red blood cells don't preserve. I'll show you an actual picture of what it looks like. There she blows. That's T-Rex. Okay? This is what they said. This is what they came up with. When your body dies, you've got iron in your body, right? That's how you carry things along in your blood system. Iron can be very detrimental to your body, so it's trapped away from the body so it can't hurt it. When you die, that iron is released instantly. Well, they've done studies and they realize that iron, once you die and it's released into your body, that iron acts as kind of a formaldehyde and it's preserving towards some of your body tissue. So they did some experiments with iron and found that they can take red blood cells and they can release this iron onto them, and they can keep them looking good for up to 2 years. They said, well, if iron can keep it looking good for 2 years, why not 64 million? Which made perfect sense to me. With no credential evidence whatsoever, because you could make some formaldehyde to help these red blood cells for 2 years, they had to come up with something because they have nothing else, right? What would you do? I'm not ridiculing. If you don't believe in God and all your cards are on evolution and you come across this, you got to come up with a formula to make it work. Their only formula was, well, this iron does preserve a little bit. It kept it for 2 years, so maybe under the right conditions it could keep it for 64 million. I am here to tell you that every scientist that really wants to be honest has to just shake their head and say there is no way, no how, anything, anywhere is going to take a fossilized bone and maintain red blood cells looking like that for 68 million years. We know it doesn't happen. Not one scientist that even saw it really even believed it. One of them told the lady, he's like, now that you think you know what you see, why don't you go back and find out what you see? Because he didn't believe it. He's like, whatever. And then once it was put in their face, they had to come up with something. Well, she used an acid burn. She burned these bones down. You know why they never found it before? They thought it was an amazing find. But these fossils are really important. So how many of them do you burn with acid? Right? They found that if they go back and burn some more, there's a lot of them that way. They have red blood cells. They have soft tissue. They're pliable. So it's just opened up the whole new world to what we thought. How in the world could these dinosaurs have lived that way that long ago? They couldn't have. Pure, plain, and simple. There's no way that soft tissue would still be there. So this demonstrates that dinosaurs were seen by humans, and that dinosaur fossils that could only last thousands of years with soft tissue are being found. Okay? We're really narrowing it down. Now, the rest of this is very credible. I've studied it for years. It's just one of those things that's so amazing you try to put it in with the Loch Ness Monster, but it's not. And that's why I want you to look it up, and it's pretty awesome. And I'll tell you a good site to go to. I go to a lot of creationist sites, and there's some good ones. And I love him, and this is why I go to him, because I trust him. If you ever go to Answers in Genesis, he is so afraid to jump on the bandwagon with anybody that he will go out of his way beyond any evolutionist alive to disprove anything he finds out that might prove creation. Because he wants to make sure he doesn't jump on something too early and be proven wrong. So I'll go and read about all kinds of things, what the secular people say, what the creationists say, and then I'll go to Answers in Genesis and see what a balanced view says. So a lot of times I'll look at them and quote them last. There's evidence in several incidences through the past several decades. Listen close. Lake Murray in New Providence and in the Africa's Congo region. Some of you will know where I'm going with this because you've heard of it. And it's so amazing, before I tell you what it is, that there are a number of evolutionists that are looking at this and saying, based on this, we might one day see a live dinosaur. Evolutionists, some are saying this. There is a, you know, the sauropod thing I was telling you about? It looks like the what we consider a brontosaurus or brachiosaurus, the big, long-necked plant eater. Well, in the jungles of Congo, let me say it right, Mokolemembe. There are many, many natives in the jungles of Congo that have seen the Mokolemembe. And what Mokolemembe means, the stopper of rivers. Because this sucker's big. And they see him in the river stopping it up. And they can go and they can say, draw me a picture of Mokolemembe. And he'll draw a sauropod, a brachiosaurus. And they can go somewhere else with that picture and show it to somebody and say, what is this? And they say, Mokolemembe, stopper of rivers. It's a known thing. They've been seeing them. We find all kinds of things in the jungles of Congo that we never knew were there or that we thought was extinct. We have found plant life that we thought was extinct millions and millions of years. There's all kinds of things coming out of the Congo. It is very conceivable. If evolutionists are even saying possibly, why would a creationist not say, yeah, we're just waiting till you get your socks blown off? Because it's very possible that they're there. And that is some very powerful evidence. But now, let me give you this one. This was the one I didn't know about that has been found to be credible. And there are so many that are not credible, and I removed them because I don't want to insult your intelligence, but these have been found to be credible, okay? This is the description that came from Western Province, and I want you to read it with me. It's pretty awesome. The creature was described as having a body as long as a dump truck, nearly 2 meters wide, with a long neck and long, slender tail. It was walking on two hind legs as thick as coconut palm tree trunks. It had two smaller forelegs. Let me try to do this for y'all. The head was similar in shape to a cow's head, with large eyes and sharp teeth as long as fingers. The skin was likened to that of a crocodile, and the creature had largish triangular scoops on the back. I'm saying it was probably a very advanced croc that had learned to walk on two legs that has since then gone extinct, or else they probably would have surpassed us on the food chain. It was what, class? Very possibly a T-Rex. If not, something of the ancestor from it. This is the description they gave. And yes, there's a lot of nutcakes out there, but these are not just your little side stories. These are things that have been taken very serious. Now, so let's look at this. We have powerful proof of dinosaurs living contemporary with men, maybe even recently. We have overwhelming proof, class, that there was a catastrophe involving great deals of water. And it's the only plausible explanation for many, many, many points in the entire fossil record. Much less all the incredible details of the fossils and the stratus and the layers. All of it can only be explained by great deals of water and cataclysmic disaster. And we're finding that out more and more. Most of the geological evidence that we've rounded up has been in the last couple of generations. We've just found this stuff. When you see stuff like this, and it's all brought about by the ark, we're studying the ark, you need to see the effects of the ark. Here it is. Get rid of your little fairy tale. Because all the evidence is in, and it's there. Now, I'm going to read you the very end of the whole story, and I'm going to throw you a 2-second lesson that's very important. Okay? And then we'll be done. We're going to leave the science for a minute, and we're going to go back to the end of the story. Genesis 8:6. So it came to pass, at the end of 40 days, that Noah opened the window of the ark, which he had made. Then he sent out a raven. Now listen close. Which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. What did the raven do? Let the raven go. Did it come back? It did. But did it come into the ark? What it did, it took off, but then it kept coming back. But it wouldn't come back to Noah. It would kind of perch on the ark and go back out. Stay gone a while, come back. Stay gone a while, come back. It continued to do this until everything was done, everything was dried up, and then it just disappeared somewhere. But didn't come back to him, it just came back to the ark. Very important. I'll come back to it in a minute. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand, took her, and drew her into the ark himself, and he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent out the dove from the ark. The dove came back in the evening, behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And olive trees will grow even up through the water. A freshly plucked olive leaf, but yet she didn't stay and build a nest, meant there's something sticking out, but she couldn't stay. All right? And Noah knew that the waters had receded from the earth, so he waited yet another 7 days, sent out the dove, third time, which he did not return again to him anymore. And it came to pass, in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from the earth. Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked. And indeed the surface of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Now, here at the end of the story, picture Noah, he sends out this raven. Right? We'll go back to that picture. Now listen to me. I read to see what everybody had to say about this because I had my own ideas and I wanted to see. And there's so many confusing things. Nobody in any commentary will give you a solid slam on this. But God writes everything for a reason, doesn't He? And I pondered this because I knew God wanted me to do something with it. And I'm not saying I've got anybody says they got dibs on God, you need to get them out of the pulpit. But I think that God showed me something that is very real here, and whether I read it wrong or not, it is very scriptural, and we need to hear it anyway. But I don't think I'm reading this wrong. A raven, what do they eat? Does anybody know? Dead things. They eat dead meat. Okay? He released a raven. Now stay with me here. Give me your eyeballs. He released a raven. The raven went out. What did he see floating all over the place? You know what he's thinking while he's flying along? I've died and gone to heaven. Woo! I'm going to eat forever. There's dead stuff floating everywhere. He's lighting on everything, trying a little of this, trying a little of that, trying a little of this, and he comes on back to the ark so he can settle down for the day. I ain't going back up in there. He won't give me none of this good fresh meat. I'll just hang out up here on top for a little while, get my sea legs again, then I'll go back out and eat again tomorrow. He stayed outside the ark at least 21 days, which means he had to be eaten and just be a glutton. He's out there eating all the dead meat he can get and coming back resting on the ark, but he never comes back to Noah. The dove, on the other hand, is a very clean bird. And it will not eat anything dead, and it will not build a nest anywhere dirty and mushy and nasty. So when it couldn't find anything to eat and nowhere to stay, nothing that would be of any interest to it, it came home and said, "Can I come back in, please? This is terrible." Okay? Now, you listening? This is where it comes home. The whole world had been made new. Everything bad had been done away with. Right? And the raven was totally attracted to and enthralled with and loving all the death of the old world. And when given a chance to come back to the ark with everything God was making new, he didn't want it. He stayed in the old world. And he continued to feast on the old world. And he didn't want to come to anything new that God had made. He stayed outside the ark and he feasted on the old world. The dove wanted everything that was made new. It didn't want any part of this nastiness. Very different two birds, aren't they? God does not put pictures in the Bible for nothing. And if you read something and say, "I don't understand that," then you need to read and think and ponder. There's something there. Here's what I want to ask you. Please listen to me. If God came into your life and my life right now and removed everything unrighteous, made a fresh start in your life, right? He removed everything that makes you fall. He magically took away everything you lust after, magically took away every woman or man that flirts with you, magically took away every bad movie that you could ever pull up on Netflix and watch when you shouldn't have, magically take away every person that you've ever gossiped with, whether you wanted to or not. Magically take away every person that you just couldn't seem to forgive and got mad at every time they came in the room. Could magically take away every job or hobby that took you away from your wife or him more than it should. If he could take away everything in your life magically and start you completely fresh and give you that buffer away from it all so that you could easily live a righteous life, would you be thrilled and grow closer to Him, or would you be longing for the dead flesh of the life that He just took away from you? Honestly, you answer that question. Would you be upset because there ain't nothing on Netflix to watch anymore? And going to work is no fun anymore because little Hotsy don't wink at me and ask me out every other week. And I got nothing to talk about anymore because all I talked about was other people. And the only thing that made me live from day to day was my hatred for Eugene. Because Eugene's a jerk. And just me living to make sure he's miserable is the only reason I'm still alive. You just took all that away from me, God. How many of you, if he did give you a clean start, would be the raven and just beg to go back and eat dead flesh? Because everything you... How much of your life right now is built on dead flesh? And you don't even realize it. You probably wouldn't realize it unless it was taken away and you begin to realize just how much you do miss it. I'm going to tell you again, we're wanting God to use us and He can't. He can't until we will stand up and we will purge our hearts and our minds and we will be usable holy vessels for Him. Does that mean you're not going to fall? No. But it means you lust after the new life and the ark and not all the dead flesh floating around it. Most of us are ravens. Now, I really didn't like telling you all that because I'd be trying to fly around some dead meat too if He took all the righteousness and put it in my life and took away the bad. But you give yourself an honest opinion right now. How many things will you go home and before you come back in here next week at this time, how many things will you have purposely indulged in that you know is part of the old world and it's just a piece of dead meat and you shouldn't be eating on it? But you do. And you know what that shows me? It shows me how much we really love Him. Shows me how real we really are in our walk and how much we're really willing to give up. Some of you, when you sit here and really tally it up, you need to wonder whether you ever really were on the ark in the first place. And that's just truth. Call that a two stupid birds. But it's true. And I'm going to close with the ending of Genesis, and we're done. Genesis 8, 20, 22. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord. How many times have you begged God and begged God and begged God to take you through something, and He delivers you, and you don't even remember to go back and give Him a 30-second thank you? But at the moment, before it happened, it was the world. You promised Him your first three children. But then you got it, and it was like, meh. First thing Noah did was build an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in His heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. Genesis 9:11. Thus I established my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I made between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I don't know whether the rainbow, I don't know whether He just kind of tweaked the laws of nature to bring it into being or because there had never been rain. I don't know what the reasons. The Bible doesn't explicitly say there was never rain. That's an assumption because of the supposed greenhouse effect. Could have been rain, could have not been rain. So we don't know how and why the rainbow first came to be here. Now, I set, God talking, 9:13, I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all the flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all the flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Do you remember when I said that Jesus had the wine and the bread, and He said, I will not drink of the wine again until I'm with you in heaven. And how beautiful that picture is. And how every time we drink of the wine now in a communion, we need to think about Jesus isn't drinking it. The next time He does, He'll be with us. Remember me telling you, the moment that I'm waiting for, I'm going to be able to talk about this. When I put my hand on those crystal walls and He puts His on mine, I'm praying He'll do it. It makes it real, doesn't it? Remember me telling you how when you have a 1,400 high wall made of crystal, two-thirds the thickness of a football field, and you have the light of Jesus Christ shining from inside, and you're like another continent over, what the skies will probably look like with that light blistering through as a rainbow in the dark sky? How beautiful that'll be. This hit me, and I'm ashamed that I've never thought about it before, but now I will. We don't have to wait. God said, this is a covenant that I prepared for all generations. He said just now in Genesis that every time the rainbow is in the sky, I will look upon it. You know, a really cute thing that I see in movies sometimes is two lovers separated by half a world say, hey, at 9 o'clock tonight, I'm going to look at the moon. I want you to look at it too, so we'll be looking at it at the same time. According to Genesis, if you believe God's word, if there's a rainbow in the sky, He says, what? I'm going to look at it. I'm going to see the rainbow and remember. So if you will, the next time, take God at His word and really know that He's real. And you look at that rainbow. Your beloved's looking at it too. And you don't have to wait till those jasper walls of crystal are there. Because He's got something there. And He's looking at it with you. And you remember that, and you have you a little worship session next time it rains. Read Psalm 29 while the thunderstorm's rolling, because it tells you all about the majesty of the storm from God. And then when it all dries up and the rainbow comes out, you can look at it and celebrate. And remember God's goodness, and remember how it broke his heart. Remember how he swore, I don't ever want to do that again. And have your moment with God. And don't be a raven. And remember, we have a lot of kids that have not heard anything you've just heard in the last 4 weeks. And they need hope, and they're misled. And the next 5 days is our opportunity. All right? Let's stand for prayer.